Hey, my name is Christopher Lowen, and this is Behind the Sermon, the podcast all about the art of preaching from those very first ideas and that writing them down in that notebook to rehearsal and practice and script writing and manuscript pulling together and illustration gathering all the way down to the moment of truth. This podcast chronicles the rocky and beautiful and terrifying and memorable process of the unique event in time known as the sermon. And, you know, on every episode here on the program, we look at a sermon that I have preached often. It's one that I have preached here at the Redlands Adventist Church. I'm here recording in my office this afternoon, and this is the place where I get the privilege and honor of serving as lead pastor. It's a beautiful thing. And as always on the program, we'll reflect on what it means to put together a sermon, what went into it, and also the many things that were overlooked and left out along the way. So thank you so much for joining me. And you'll know that this is an episode that I'm recording in my office on video. So if you're normally listening, you can join us on YouTube. And I can share some more. Well, at least you can see my mug, but maybe we'll add in some other, you know, accoutrement, and we'll also run the video of the sermon. But as always, it'll be available on the podcast. The first segment of our program is always a segment called Context is Everything. What was trying to happen here with this sermon? What were we doing? What was the sermon about? Where were we going? Where were we headed? What were we trying to do? What was the goal of this thing? And this was the second sermon in the sermon series on mountains and valleys. Mountains and valleys. Traveling through or navigating, managing, I can't remember the subtitle. Life's Rugged Circumstances, and it's kind of all about how to get through the hard times in life. And of course, mountains are a great metaphor for difficulty and challenges in life. And I had had on my list, I use the Microsoft To-Do program that used to be Wunderlist, and I use that program, and I had on my list the idea of doing a sermon series that was on mountains, you know, the mountains of the Bible and so on. And I thought that would be fun. And then, you know, it kind of came up that 2020 has been a bit of a bear and has had a lot of tough times. And so those two things sort of fit together. And so that's where we're headed. I've been working through the sermon series we've been working through, this is just the second week of the thing. We started with Ararat, Mount Ararat, which is where, you know, kind of the story surrounding Noah's flood. And then this week we went to Mount Moriah. And if you're not familiar with Mount Moriah, well, you'll hear all about it in the sermon. But the most famous story, arguably, that takes place on Mount Moriah is Abraham's would-be sacrifice of his son Isaac. And you know, like I mentioned in the sermon, there are some traditions, although there isn't a wide agreement among scholars on this. There are some who think that Mount Moriah is also one and the same as the Temple Mount, and that the, you know, the temple in Jerusalem and the mountain that it's on is the same thing as Moriah. And so definitely the most famous story is the story of Isaac. And man, there's been so much written and talked about. I mean, especially the rabbinical Jewish rabbinic tradition around the story of Isaac and Abraham is rich and all sorts of stuff. And the stated goal of this sermon, and the, you know, the difficult life circumstance that I was kind of going for or talking about, was the circumstance of loss. And I acknowledged this early on in the sermon that Mount Moriah doesn't necessarily seem you know, on the surface, like you know, a topic about loss or a story about loss. And you know, this may have been one of those incidences, and now we're flowing into we're flowing into the microphone therapist a little bit here, but this may have been one of those interesting instances where I was trying to fit a round peg into a square hole, or what preachers sometimes call eisegesis, which is, exegesis is you let the sermon flow out of the text, out exegesis, out of the text, and eisegesis is you're putting things into the text. So I may have been forcing it, and I own that. But my goals with the sermon were to be of encouragement for those who are going through loss. I wanted to give a little bit of a pushback and a challenge against some of the ways that I think that we navigate loss in ways that are unhelpful, and maybe, I don't know, maybe not challenge necessarily, but for folks who are going through loss, kind of maybe encouraging them to think deeply about the kinds of things that we're going through. And then also, there's a bit, and maybe this is the challenge piece, but there's a bit of a prophetic critique in there, sort of talking about, if you listen to the sermon, I talked about, what are our modern day Molechs? Molech is this, Canaanite god that people would sacrifice their children to. And I made the argument in the sermon that was kind of a culturally acceptable coping mechanism. That was sort of my underlying argument. And so I wanted to draw the parallel of what culturally acceptable coping mechanisms do we have in our culture that we inherit and buy into, but that maybe are not so helpful or not very functional. And, I don't know if any of them that we inherit are as dysfunctional as sacrificing your children. I think that there are things that we do that are not so helpful. And I mentioned some of them, numbing ourselves out and distracting ourselves with entertainment and consumerism and so on and those sorts of things. So I think that the goal of the sermon was to invite people to consider that, to sort of look at their life. And then I think in the broadest sense, to embrace hope that, even though we may be going through loss, even though we may be going through a dark valley, that all is not lost, that we're going to make it. We're going to pull through this moment in time of the pandemic, and we're going to pull through in the big picture as well, that we serve a God who is great and who's good, and who is faithful and who is with us. And maybe that's a, kind of a tangential thing that I wanted to challenge is there's kind of this underlying assumption, there's an underlying tension in the story, and some of it I think, is brought about by the text itself, admittedly. I think that there's some tension in the story where it's kind of, we sort of take it at face value, or maybe we even read into it and we kind of think, well, God was wanting Abraham to sacrifice his son, right? God was wanting him to kill his son. And I feel like we jump on that bandwagon maybe a little bit too quickly. And I feel very strongly that this story and this whole experience and this, conversation between Abraham and God was a critique and a challenge of some of the prevailing ways of doing things and some of the prevailing ways of relating with God. I think that God was making a statement about himself and how he was different from the surrounding cultural assumptions, not unlike the story of Noah, actually. There's some fire there for me, if you will, that I like that piece. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So there's the context, there's where we were headed, and that's what we were trying to do. And you may recognize, especially once we go and play the sermon, I preached right here in my office, and I was trying a little bit of an experiment this week. I wanted to stand and have a little bit more of a kind of an ordinary situation where how I would normally be if we were having regular church and not in this crazy COVID time. And then this whiteboard was kind of a new experiment to play with a little bit. But here I am. I'm filming again and recording this episode of the podcast right here from my office. So for those of you who have heard the sermon already, you can bounce forward. It was about 28, 29 minutes or so. And this week I'm including the testimony of our church member who was a part of it. And she had about a 3 or 4 minute poem that she wrote that was a testimony from her life that was deeply, deeply powerful. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we get further into the show. But if you've already heard it, you can fast forward. But if not, we're going to go ahead and play the sermon right now. So here it is. Enjoy. Oh, man. Well, the pressure's on, Mr. H. Thank you for the story and for the challenge, too, of advice. So we'll see how that goes. We are in a sermon series right now on mountains and valleys. In fact, it's called Mountains and Valleys: How to Survive Life's Rugged Circumstances. It's a survival guide for getting through life. And we're looking at all different stuff, like different hardships, different struggles, different things that we go through that make life difficult. And of course, we're in this season of life that is tough right now. And to kind of get at those rugged circumstances, we're doing storytelling of different mountains that are in the Bible, different mountains that are in Scripture. And I actually want to do a bit of a poll for you, and we're going to start off early so you can get your devices out. And I'm going to screen share here my screen with you. We have a poll everywhere poll. And so what you do for this one is you get out your device and go to www.pollEverywhere or pollev.com/ChristopherLowe728. It's right up there at the top of the window. You should be able to see it. So you go to that website and you can vote on things. And the thing that I want you to vote on right now is, which of the stories about these mountains, which ones are you familiar with? And this is one where you can say yes to every single one. If you're familiar with all of them, you can say yes to every single one. But if you're like me, where you're maybe not so familiar with all of them, vote for, you know, just a few of them. So I'm just kind of curious to see, like, you know, how many of these are we actually familiar with? You know, Zion, Horeb, Tabor, you know, some more of us are maybe are familiar with Sinai. I don't, you know, it's all sorts of different ones. So go in there and vote. Share with us which ones of these that you're the most familiar with, and we'll see it update here. But we're going to be going through all sorts of different mountains. You may recall last week our sermon began on the mountain of Ararat, Mount Ararat, which was the one that the Ark landed on, Noah's Ark landed on. And today we are at Mount Moriah. And I just want to see the results here. I got to move this little window. I'm sorry if my mouse here is bugging you. It looks like our the one that we have the least collective knowledge about is Tabor and Pisgah and Nebo. And I'm right there with you. So we'll discover together when we get to that a few weeks down the road. Some of us who are part of the kind of the Adventist education tradition, we are aware of Mount Pisgah Academy in North Carolina. But I believe that this biblical Pisgah is not located in North Carolina. My colleagues can, you know, give me a thumbs up on that if you agree. I don't know. But anyway, interesting. Well, thanks for voting. We're going to have a couple more polls, so keep your devices handy, and we'll make use of those in just a moment as we move through. But like I said, today we are working through a sermon series on Mount Moriah. And there's quite a few Old Testament stories that are related to Mount Moriah. One of the most famous is the binding of Isaac, the Ha Akedah in the Hebrew, the binding of Isaac, super famous story, and that's the one we're going to look at today. But there's a bunch of other stories related to Mount Moriah. In fact, there's some traditions actually say and teach that the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is or was Mount Moriah. And the reason that we're going to talk about Mount Moriah this week is because it has a great deal to teach us about loss. It has a great deal to teach us about loss and also the threat of loss. And of course, loss is ubiquitous for life as a human. I mean, we talked all about it last winter. We had a sermon series in the Book of Lamentations. It began in January of 2020, primed, apparently. We didn't know it at the time, but primed for the year that was coming to us in 2020. We had five weeks on grief and loss back there, and we looked at all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, perhaps loss, we could probably define it as the definitive rugged circumstance that is life. I mean, just think about the losses that we have faced this week alone. And I actually have a second poll for you. Give me a second here. Let me get it activated. Let's see here. Uh-oh. All right, here we go. So I want to ask you to share a word that represents a loss that you've experienced in the past 30 days. And I'm just going to put some down here up on my board. As Pastor Lindsay mentioned, you know, many of us reflected on yesterday, the losses that we experienced related to 9/11. Some of you were not alive yet at that point. In your experience, but for many of us, man, what a crazy moment that really changed the world in a lot of ways. And then thinking about the wars that followed and the loss of life, and now something that we're dealing with in America still is the suicide rate amongst veterans and soldiers who were in those wars. Just crazy, crazy stuff that we reflected on just yesterday, the loss that related to 9/11. Of course, there's all sorts of stuff related to COVID-19, right? And apparently there's nines and ones in both of these, so stay away from that. But I think about deaths. You know, I talked to people this week who have had family members pass away because of illness, the COVID-19 illness, and man, joining the nearly 200,000 people who have died in our country alone. And you know, thinking about it as a pastor, you know, my first year here, first 18 months here at the Redlands Church, it's been kind of a crazy year, and especially a crazy 6 months. Man, it's not exactly what I would have wished it, you know. I think about dreams that have been lost. I have some friends, one friend who's a member of this congregation who qualified for the Boston Marathon and had to run that on a trail in the woods instead of at Boston. And I have friends back in Walla Walla. Same thing, they qualified for the Boston. I saw a picture of one of my friends in Walla Walla who was out there running it in the smoke, which is incredible dedication, just nuts. But man, loss of dreams that happen. Some of us have lost jobs. Right? Some of us have gone through that sort of change. Some of us have lost, you know, stability and balance in our lives. You know, and then just sort of moving forward to more local stuff. We here in Southern California, but all over the West Coast really have experienced the loss and the threat of loss related to fires, right? Some of us have had to evacuate and leave our homes. Just all sorts of losses, and we are just talking about loss that we've experienced in the last 90 days, right? Just in the last little while, loss is ubiquitous. And so, believe it or not, I think that the story of the Akedah, the story of the binding of Isaac on Mount Moriah, this is where it comes in. It has a lot to do with loss. So I just want to read with you, and you can pull out your Bibles if you want. I have one here on my little stand in front of me. I have one in print, but you may have one in a different place on your phone or on a tablet or whatever. But pull out your Bible to Genesis chapter 22. That's where we find the story of the binding of Isaac. Genesis chapter 22. And I'm just going to read a little bit and then talk a little bit, all right? So Genesis chapter 22, verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." And he replied, "Here I am." Verse 2, then God said, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you. What a mountain. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey, and he took him and two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac. And when he'd cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place, the top of the mountain that God had told him about. And if you know the story, you know what comes next. They made their way up to the top of the mountain, and Isaac asks, hey, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says, God will provide. And then along in the process goes, the text says, which is a horrific thought, it says that Abraham bound Isaac. I mean, we're not really told. A lot of the traditions kind of speak to the idea that Isaac was willing in this process and didn't fight back and so on. But we're not really told, at least in Genesis chapter 22. And then along the way, an angel comes and says, stop, Abraham, don't do this. And then as it unfolds, a ram is found in the bushes, and Abraham sacrifices the ram. And then the story closes in Genesis chapter 22, where Abraham names the place Moriah, which means God will provide, or the Lord will provide. Now, this story may not immediately strike you as having much to do with loss. So if that's running through your head right now, you are not alone. You are not alone, all right? If you're kind of thinking, man, this story does not sound at all like it has anything to do with loss. It sounds like it has something to do with faith. Sure, it has something to do with testing. You know, if you read Ellen White's comments on the story, it's all about testing. Yes, it sounds like, but loss? I mean, there's all sorts of theological issues that come up. This is one of the most discussed stories and debated challenges certainly in the Jewish world and definitely in the Christian world as well. So if you're thinking, this doesn't really sound like loss, you're not alone. But let me give you a little bit of backstory, okay? Let me give you a little bit of a backstory. The story of the Adakah that's found in Genesis chapter 22, if you go backwards, if you go to the left in your Bible, and I'm pointing to my left. I don't know if you're seeing that as your left or my left. I don't know which left it is. But so if we go back a little bit in your Bible, if you go back four chapters to Genesis chapter 18, we find some of a backstory, all right? This is another kind of disturbing, dark story, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is an infamous one. It's famous. It's infamous. It's mistakenly, repeatedly used as kind of a battering ram amongst Christians and in not the best ways at all. But the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is a story where God destroys these towns, right? So here I'm gonna give you a little bit of a comparison here. We're gonna pull this up here. So we have Genesis 18, Sodom and Gomorrah, right? We read in the story, I'm just going to summarize it for you. All this stuff happens, the town sort of shows itself to not be a real great place. And God comes to Abraham and says, listen, I'm going to destroy this town. And Abraham responds with a ton of vigor against God. God, you cannot do this. It's one of the stories in the scripture where someone argues with God vehemently, vociferously, right? Abraham says, God, what are you thinking? You cannot do this. It conjures up some of the arguments that we see from Moses arguing with God. So Abraham is arguing with God on behalf of the Sodom and Gomorrah, and he starts listing off all these terms, right? He says, like, well, what if there's 100 people that are still good? Would you save the town? And what if there were 50 people that were good? Would you still save the town? What if there were only 10 people that were good? They were still, and the story kind of goes over the top to sort of explain, listen, that town was just depraved. There wasn't even 10 people that were good. But Abraham argues and argues and argues. He just throws an absolute fit with God. He throws a fit. God, you cannot destroy these people who were admittedly pretty terrible people. Now, that happens in Genesis 18. I want you to contrast that in your mind with how Abraham responds to God in Genesis chapter 22, when God says, listen, I want you to take your son, your own kid, the one you love, your only son, I want you to take him and sacrifice him. What kind of fit does Abraham throw in that circumstance? It's crickets. Not a peep. He doesn't fight with God one tiny bit. I mean, when God proposes he's gonna destroy these towns of people that are terrible, Abraham loses his mind. But when he says to kill his kid, he's like, all right, you got a deal. I mean, what? Now, some of us might kind of say, well, you know, over those four chapters, a lot of years have gone by, and Abraham has grown, and he's matured, and he's a better person, and sure, that may be true. There may be some truth to that, but I think that there's more happening in this story, and I think that it has a lot to do with loss and avoiding loss. So let's go back a little bit further. We were in Genesis 22, and then we're in Genesis 18. Let's go back a little bit further to the beginning of Abraham's life and his story with God. If you go all the way back to Genesis 12, you'll find the calling of Abraham. But if you go a little bit further than that, it's not really recorded. It's sort of just mentioned in the Bible. But if we go all the way before God's calling to Abraham's childhood, we will find that Abraham was born in a city called Ur in the Chaldean Empire. It's kind of where, sort of on the border of modern-day Iraq and Iran, you know, kind of down there in the Euphrates River Valley. And it's among a people group that were known as Mesopotamians, the ancient Mesopotamian people. And it's a very similar people group that he lived among when he was in Haran, which is kind of in southeastern Turkey. So his father moved the family up. It's very similar to the people that he lived among in Iran, and it's in Haran. And it's a very similar type of group of people who he lived among when he finally made his way to Canaan. Now, if you aren't familiar, when Abraham was a child, his father moved the family up to southeastern Turkey, to Haran, and then when God called Abraham in Genesis 12, he moved down into Canaan, more closer to the coast. Now, ancient Mesopotamian religions, and this is a gross oversimplification, okay? So, you know, I have friends who are experts in reading and writing cuneiform tablets that are ancient, and you know all sorts of stuff, so please forgive my oversimplification. But ancient Mesopotamian religion was polytheistic, right? So there are thousands of gods, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 different gods, and the vast majority of them were anthropomorphic, which means they kind of had human-type form and human-type attributes, and some of them were kind of nasty and terrible, and some of them did wonderful, beautiful things. It was kind of a wide variety. But essentially, one of the themes amongst the polytheistic religion of the Mesopotamian people was that gods kind of needed stuff from humans. They needed humans to provide for them. Kind of a contrast between what Moriah was named, right? God will provide. It's sort of the exact opposite, where it was actually humans will provide. Humans will take care of the God. The gods need food and drink, and they need supplies, and they need to be taken care of, and so on. And so they needed to be sacrificed. And many people who were part of ancient Mesopotamian religion, many people believed that if you went through loss in your life, if you went through death, or you went through illness, or you lost someone you love, or you went through a financial hardship, or you went through these things that we were just talking about, if your home burns down, you have to evacuate, or if a war, if something bad happens in your life, if you go through loss, it very likely could be because a god, a nefarious or angry god, is after you and is not happy with something you did. And so a lot of people in ancient Mesopotamian religion, they believed that you needed to appease gods with sacrifices and gifts, and you need to make sure, you need to make sure they're happy if you want your harvest to go well, and if you want your finances to be right. If you want to avoid loss in your life, you need to bring sacrifices to God. And so what can happen is, when people are stressed And when they're anxious and when they're afraid, it was really, really important to soothe these angry gods, to placate their needs, to look after them. And there are a number of threads in ancient Mesopotamian religion. There are many threads that feature child sacrifice, something that was used to appease those gods. In other words, you know, to keep our losses at arm's length, we'll use a loss of a child as a way of keeping away even worse losses that could be in front of us. And the practice was so well known that when we read through the book of Leviticus, for example, there are a number of very specific commands in the book of Leviticus that say, do not sacrifice your children to the god Molech, which was kind of the main god that people sacrificed their kids to, Molech. You know, I've made the comment more than once. If there is a law for it, it must have been a problem. If there's a law for it, it must have been problem. There's a lot of strange laws out there. We won't go down that road. There's lots of interesting laws, and the reason we make a law is because it was a problem, and it's named no less than three times very specifically in Leviticus. Do not do this. And the reason it was named is because people were doing it. They were influenced by the people they lived among. Israelite people were. So let me summarize all of this, all right? Abraham grew up among a people and was related to, and had relatives who, and lived his adult life among people who, believed that loss could be managed and controlled by, among other things, child sacrifice. Abraham lived in a culture, whether we're talking about Canaan or Haran or his place of birth out in Ur, he lived among a culture where it was normal to cope with loss or to cope with the threat of loss by sacrificing everything in my life, including my kids, to angry gods. Abraham's ancestors had that point of view. Abraham's, for generations, everyone around Abraham, his neighbors, the people he bought bread from, he was surrounded in a culture that believed that you could manage loss by sacrificing your kids. So, here's the thing. I don't think that God's test of Abraham was about Abraham's faith really at all. I think God's test of Abraham was about his underlying belief system. I think God wanted to see just how deeply the culture that he lived among and within. I think God wanted to see just how deeply that culture had affected him. You see, you know, if Abraham, God wanted to see if whether or not if Abraham assumed that God, if Yahweh, was like Molech. I think God wanted to test if Abraham believed that God needed to be appeased. If God was angry, if he was nefarious, or if he had some crazy agenda. I think that the Adakah, the binding of Isaac, this story, I think it's a lesson in contrast. I think God wanted to show the difference between himself and the surrounding cultural milieu. And as he had been from the very beginning of the Abraham story, all the way from Genesis chapter 12, I believe God was trying to announce something new in the world. Through Abraham, I think God was announcing, I am different from these other gods. I'm different from these other belief systems. I'm different from this other way of doing things. I don't cause people loss. I don't cause people suffering. You don't need to appease me. I'm not angry at you. I'm not out to get you. My love for you is absolutely unconditional. My plans are bigger and more beautiful than you could possibly imagine. In fact, you don't need to provide for me. I will provide for you. And if I'm right about this, if at least part of the lesson of the Moriah story is about who God is and less about who Abraham is, and kind of had a disturbing, deformed faith that he assumed that God wanted to kill, that God wanted him to kill his own kid. If the story of Abraham is more about God than it is about Abraham, then I think it has something to teach us about loss and how we relate to loss and how we relate to the threat of loss in life. You know, it's easy, I think, to be judgmental of the Canaanites. You know, how big of an idiot do you have to be to believe that killing your kid is going to improve your life, right? I think it's easy to be judgmental of that worldview and that way of thinking. But honestly, you know, we do similar types of things to cope, at least in a similar mindset. You know, I think one of the most challenging things about loss is the way it makes us feel so powerless. Whether loss is coming our direction or whether or not we are in loss, it makes us feel powerless. There's nothing that we can do to fix it. When we're going through sickness, or we experience the death of a loved one, or if we're going through divorce, or we're in the middle of a pandemic and we can't do anything but stay home, or if we experience a terrorism attack, or we go through a natural disaster, we are stuck. There's very frequently nothing we can do. Maybe we can run away, but there's nothing we can do. And for a lot of us, our knee-jerk reaction is that we would do almost anything to get out of the situation. And I think part of the human condition is to create all sorts of coping mechanisms to make us feel better, to help us feel like we can prevent the loss from happening or to deal with the pain. And so my argument today is we have all sorts of modern day Molechs that we live with and that we've inherited in American culture. No, we're not doing the child sacrifice thing, but we do all sorts of stuff to cope with loss and with the threat of loss. I heard a story in the last year that I found amusing. It's about a guy named Charles Crocker. Charles Crocker, and I think he's about as curmudgeonly as he looks in this picture. You know, it's just a fantastic image of this guy. But he was a railroad executive who lived in New York. In fact, he was the executive of the Central Pacific Railroad that was part of the Transcontinental Railroad that made it all the way across the country and ended up in San Francisco. And after the railroad was completed, this guy, Charles Crocker from New York, he wanted to build himself a house, in fact, a mansion in San Francisco, which is great. And so he picked out a plot of land up there on Knob Hill, and he built himself a mansion. But, you know, in order to do that, this Mr. Charles Crocker, he had to acquire the land on this block. And some of you may know this story. I don't know, maybe you're familiar with it, but he needed to acquire this land. He wanted to build a big mansion up there on Knob Hill, and he wanted to have the whole block. And so he started buying up different properties on this block so he could build the big mansion. And everybody sold, and some of you know where this is going. Some people sold, but then there was one dude who refused to sell his house to Mr. Charles Crocker, railroad executive. Thank you very much. You are not invited to buy my house. I'm going to keep my house. It was a man named Nicholas Young. And he had a little tiny house that was not mansion-like at all. And he refused to sell it to Mr. Charles Crocker. And you know, Mr. Charles Crocker experienced some loss in that. He had a dream of building a mansion. He had a dream of having this great, amazing place that took up a whole city block where he owned every single little plot of land, and Nicholas Young was blocking him from that. He caused him loss. He was destroying his dream. In fact, Nicholas Young absolutely, utterly refused to sell the land. And so Charles Crocker built his mansion on that land, and he was forced to build it around Nicholas Young's small house. And you know how Charles Crocker dealt with his loss? You know what he did to cope with his loss? You can see it here on this picture. If you go to the next slide, Todd, I've highlighted it. He built a spite wall. He built the walls of his house so high that Mr. Nicholas Young could not see out in any direction except for out his front door. It's called a spite wall. It's a technical term, and in fact, on the Southern California on the California law books, to speaking of strange laws, there's a law that says you cannot build a spite wall. If your neighbor makes you mad, Mr. Rob, if your neighbor makes you mad, you cannot build a 30-foot fence to block their view of the mountain. You can't do it. It's against the law. You cannot build a spite fence or a spite wall, and you can't plant a spite tree. It's against the law. But, you know, we do all... It's funny, too, if you go on to the story, both of their houses burned down or were destroyed in the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, and now the Episcopalian Grace Cathedral sits on that plot of land. So there you go. But we as people, we are so creative in how we deal with loss or how we try to avoid loss. We do all sorts of things. We have many modern day Molechs that we use to cope with our loss. And you know, some of them are constructive and some of them are deconstructive. We do all sorts of things. I love this line from Peter Enns, who writes about this story in his book, The Sin of Certainty. He writes, "When we sacrifice our children to Molech, we are reaching to trade security and the concrete, even if it's unimaginably horrible. We are reaching to trade security in exchange for the ethereal, for the possible, for promises, or even for trust." And of course, in Southern California culture, we do not have child sacrifice, but we have all sorts of stuff that we inherit, all sorts of coping mechanisms that just come to us, that are just normal, that are similarly obvious. That's how culture works. It just, we swim in it, and we don't even necessarily notice. And like I said, some of them are deconstructive, some of them are constructive, some of them are helpful. And often there are times when we know this thing doesn't help at all, but it kind of makes us feel better, and so we do it anyway. Our culture teaches, for example, that if someone attacks you and hurts you, that you need to fight back. You need to build a spite wall for them. You need to drop a bunch of bombs, right? If this is what our culture teaches, if someone hurts you, if someone causes life in your life, one of the good ways to cope is to cause loss back. One of the things, that's one Molech, I would argue. But you know, our culture also teaches, and this is, you know, we're still growing on this. There are segments of the culture that aren't quite there yet. But one of the things that our culture teaches is if you go through traumatic loss, one of the good coping mechanisms is to go to therapy and to participate in small groups and connect with community. So that, in my judgment, that's a great coping mechanism. It doesn't make the loss go away, but it's a way that we can work our way through. Our culture teaches, for example, that if we're overwhelmed, if we're terrified of loss that seems to be coming our way, if we're overwhelmed with the loss that we're going through, you can numb it with all sorts of different substances. We got lots of different options. You can numb yourself. You can distract yourself with entertainment. How many times have you guys heard people talk? And I'm sinner number one here, so don't think I'm being judgmental. But how many times have you guys heard people talk about how important it was for the NBA to start up again? They're doing this whole elaborate bubble down in Florida, and they're playing games every single day. And people have talked about how important it is for Americans to be able to be entertained by grown men playing a game, right? It's quite the coping mechanism. Entertainment is getting distracted. One of the things that American culture teaches, we teach that we can repress our loss and we can externalize it as judgment or gossip on other people. That's one of the, we can avoid it by being selfish and self-protective. Our culture teaches all sorts of ways of coping with loss. You know, one of the ways that it teaches us to cope with loss that I think is constructive is it teaches us to take action and to be resilient and to have hope and to keep going and to keep trying and to not give up and to not give up and to not give up and to not give up. It's one of the beautiful parts of American culture. You know, some of us, we've inherited the coping mechanism in American culture of just being frenetic. if we see loss in front of us, or if we go through loss, as long as I'm active in doing stuff, as long as I'm frenetically doing things, that's a way of coping with loss. Some of my church members here in Redlands sent me a sermon this week from Stephen Furtick, where he talks about, you know, coping with anxiety by going in circles. And it feels like you're doing something, but you're not actually getting anywhere. Completely agree. So here's a question for you, and we're going to do our third poll everywhere poll here today, our third and final one. But here's the question for you. When you are in loss, when you are faced with loss, when you're faced with feeling powerless, which among the ones that I'm given, and I probably haven't given all the ones, and maybe I didn't give yours, but which among these possible coping mechanisms, which ones of these do you tend to go to first? Which one is your choice one? Because I think if you're anything like me, and maybe I'm all alone in this, but if you're anything like me, you kind of have a whole basket of coping mechanisms, of Molechs. And maybe there's some Molechs, and then there's some that are more helpful over here. There are some that are constructive and some that are deconstructive. But where do you go when you're going through loss? Again, you just go to pollev.com/ChristopherLowe728 and you can vote. And so share with us. Where do you go when you are stuck in powerlessness, when you're stuck in loss? When you're stuck in that place, where do you go?
Click activate.
Yeah, it is. It says it's active. I don't know, maybe it's not. It doesn't appear to be working. Well, we got 2 out of 2. All right, I'll stop the screen share. Now, you may have noticed last week that we had Sky Shear, who joined our congregation by a profession of faith, but she also gave a testimony and shared a little bit about her faith journey. And that's something that we're going to be doing every week, or at least most weeks, through this Mountain and Valley Sermon Series. We're going to be looking at life circumstances, the difficult, rugged parts of life that we go through. This week we talked about loss, for example, right? But we're going to be talking about some of those, and we're going to be asking some of our church members to share from their own lives. How have you experienced this thing? How have you been through it? How have you managed to make it through, for example, loss? And so I'm excited, super excited about those of you who have been willing and who have signed up and said yes. And I've already been receiving some of your video recordings back to share with the community. And today we get to hear from Martha Myers. And, you know, if you listen carefully to her testimony today, and we're going to listen to her right now, if you listen carefully, you're going to hear her talk about some of the losses that she's been through in life. And if you listen carefully, you will hear her talk about some of the ways that she's dealt with those losses that's been deconstructive, that's not been super helpful to her. And if you listen closely, she's going to name some other ways that she's gone through that loss that has been deeply helpful to make it through and to become the great person that she is today. And I think this is true for all of us. We all have to deal with loss. It's ubiquitous. It's part of life. We all will go through it. And the question is how do we deal with it? How do we deal? We deal with it ways that are destructive and hurtful, or ways that help build us up and that lead us out to the other side as survivors. So I want to hear from Martha, who's going to describe how God was with her all the way. So let's play that video, and then I'll be right back with you on the other side.
For the Redlands Seventh-day Adventist Church, a psalm of Martha, sung to the tune of Great is Thy Faithfulness, and accompanied by trumpet, drums, organ, tambourine, and dancing. Oh God, how wonderful You are! You never gave up on me, even when I ignored You and went seeking my own answers. Even when I chose to look at life through my 3D glasses of divorce, disease, and depression, You sent gentle reminders that You were present with me through it all. Great is Your faithfulness. Post-divorce, when I went looking for love and validation in all the wrong places, You reminded me that I'm loved and adored by You. It took me a long time to accept that and Your forgiveness, yet You remained faithful. When disease showed up and I learned it was cancer, I turned my back on you a little while. You waited patiently for me to turn back to you. Great is your faithfulness. When my business failed and I lost the friendship of my business partner for a few years, you restored that friendship, and it remained strong until her death a year ago. When I was not present for my daughters because I let my own troubles consume me, you put people in their lives to bridge the gaps in my parenting. Great is your faithfulness. When depression set in and I took to my bed with the TV to keep me company, even then, through the characters of soap operas and movies, you helped me realize my life was not so bad. When I thought a quart of ice cream, two burritos, a large bag of chips, and a family-sized package of cookies would satisfy the emptiness, you filled me with your love and healed my food addictions. I went seeking other philosophies and ways of thinking, and even while reading that material and listening to those voices, you did not forsake me. You kept showing up in tiny ways to tenderize my heart and turn it to seeking you. Great is your faithfulness. I did not always see you in the moment, God, or acknowledge your presence, but you were there. A book purchased and put on a shelf, unread, but picked up to read on a day when the words were most needed. You were there in that moment. An unexpected phone call or encouragement, a conversation with a stranger that left me smiling, the lyrics of a song passing through my mind. You were in those moments. Great is your faithfulness. Sitting on my front porch for the past 18 years, surrounded by majestic trees, with the sound of birds singing, squirrels chuckering, a hummingbird hovering over my head, the bear or deer crossing the road in front of me. These are your healing moments. And now I'm evacuated my home with the threat of fire coming into my town and fear and anxiety are bubbling up. So I turn to you and you remind me that you see every sparrow fall and have all the woodland creatures, myself and my neighbors, in your care, whatever the outcome. Great is your faithfulness. God, the numbered hairs on my head are gray. This 73-year-old self has not lived a perfect life. I face disappointment and loss, but have finally learned to put my total trust in you. I've learned it is better to seek the light of your face first than to walk blindly through the day. I will praise you for the rest of my days. Great is your faithfulness.
Wow.
Wow.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you so much, Martha.
What a gift.
You know, today, as you are thinking about the losses that you've been through,
or maybe the losses that are on the horizon, the things you've been trying to avoid,
maybe you don't know how you're coping.
Maybe totally blind to you.
Maybe part of your work is to discover.
Maybe part of your work has to do with relating to our God
in a different way.
God who is not like other gods, God who provides for us, not requires us to provide for Him.
I don't know what work you need to do.
Maybe your work is simply to show up.
You know, when God calls Abraham in the beginning, back in Genesis 12,
Abraham responds with these words,
I am here.
And then when God calls him a little bit later,
God calls him in our chapter, Genesis chapter 2, Abraham says,
Hineni,
I'm here.
And then when Abraham's on top of the mountain, coping the way that he knows how to cope, God calls down to Abraham, and says, Hineni, I'm here.
You know, there's a Jewish tradition around that word, that single word is a prayer.
It's one of the simplest prayers.
And sometimes it's called the prayer for the ability to pray.
So for some of us, we may be in a place, thinking about our loss, potential loss, where we don't have anything else to do but to show up and to say, hinani, God, I'm here.
I want to pray with you.
I'm going to break script here for a moment, and I just want to pray with you.
And then we're going to go to the music.
And there's a couple other things on the manuscript, Todd, and we're going to skip it.
Dear Jesus, we are surrounded by threats
and loss.
And problems,
difficulties.
We're surrounded by the possibility of losing happiness, losing moments.
There are kids who are participating in church today whose school years have been thrown apart.
Some of us here are seniors in high school, and we're experiencing loss surrounding all sorts of expectations and hopes and dreams about what senior year is supposed to be.
Some of us have lost positions or influence, or dreams, or vacations, or jobs, or income. We've lost so many things.
And there's so many more scary crazy things that appear to be on the horizon.
Dear Jesus, I pray that we might have the posture that Martha demonstrated and led us in this morning.
May we have the posture of people who pray, is your faithfulness all the way through it all.
Pray that we find ways to connect with the community, to pray with you, even if it's just a simple prayer.
God, I'm here.
I only have the ability to show up, but that's all I have now.
Dear Jesus, help us to navigate loss well.
Help us to be people who, in our navigation of loss, help us to be people who do not create more in our wake, who do not harm others in our wake.
Please go with us. Please walk with us.
May we make Redlands a little bit more like your kingdom.
May we love like Jesus, pray in your name.
Amen.
Let's sing our final song together.
All right, we are back after the sermon. I hope you enjoyed that. I had a good time preaching this one, actually. It was fun to interact with the whiteboard a little bit.
I kind of screwed up, and I thought that we had a closing song.
In fact, I could have sworn we had one ready to go. But sadly, we did not.
And I was mistaken on that. I hate to do that to our church, to our team. We have a lot of people who are working behind the scenes to make this Zoom church experience work.
We're live streaming it out on our website and all sorts of stuff.
And so I hate to kind of have little snafus like that where it's my fault, it might look like someone else's fault.
But how do you get through it? We give each other grace, and we'll make it through.
So the second segment, if you don't count the sermon, the second segment of the program is called Microphone Therapist.
And it's a segment where I process and unload, and it's kind of what this whole podcast is about. You get behind the sermon, the backstory, how I felt, what was going on, what I didn't like, and what I did like, and all the different things that go into it.
And like I said, I liked this sermon.
I found the week to be a challenging week.
My kids had no school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
So it sort of made it so that I had to take the days off. I mean, I wasn't off, but I got up early in the morning and worked a few hours, and then I had to go back in the evenings and work, and then I had some miscellaneous meetings in the afternoons, and it was just a really disjointed, stressful week. It was hard to give my full attention to prepping.
So one of the outflows of that was that I didn't get the manuscript finished until late Friday.
Friday night, and I got the visual sent out finally at that time, and that's a little bit later in the game, I wish, and it's kind of our habit, so it felt a little disjointed.
I did have the opportunity to run through it a couple of times, and I was able to make some edits, so I like that.
My favorite part of the sermon was early on.
I love the turn at the beginning where kind of talking about Abraham, and talking about the story. I love the turn at the beginning.
You know, I make this comparison between the way that Abraham responds to God in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. I know that it kind of has a little bit of being up, Sodom and Gomorrah, and I know that there's a lot of pain, and especially given the fact that the reason I was bringing it up and especially given the fact that the reason I was bringing it up really has nothing to do with the way that it is, but I love that contrast, you know, that on the one hand God threatens to blow up a whole town, Abraham freaks out, not okay at all, and then on the other hand God tells him, hey, your son who is like the representative of my whole promise to you and the blessing that's going to come through for generation after generation, that son I want, he needs to die, and Abraham, on the one hand, throws a fit, but on the other hand, Isaac is just super chill. And I love raising that question, and I think that the logic in it may be a bit of a stretch, you know, I think someone could argue, well, those are categories of situations, you know, the sermon itself mentioned that it could have been that Abraham grew a little bit, but all of that to me is less compelling than the argument that I gave, which is that Child sacrifice for Abraham and child sacrifice for Isaac was normal.
And maybe they didn't already know, or maybe they didn't already assume that God was like that.
But I don't think it's too much of a stretch to argue that they could easily assume, and maybe even by getting the suggestion from God, by hearing that instruction from God, they could have made the assumption, oh God, okay, well God's like that, okay, well, we know that happens, we know about that, so we'll go with it.
I mean, there are some hints in the story that kind of lead us away from that a little bit, like where Isaac asks where the sacrifice is, and Abraham says God, and that kind of stuff. But man, it's a compelling idea to me that this was something that Abraham would have grown up with.
So I love that turn at the beginning, and just the whole premise for the sermon I find really powerful and striking. You know, I'm not totally sure, to kind of shift gears on something I didn't like. I like this idea, but I don't know if my use of it was the best. And for those of you who are pointing to the whiteboard, I haven't moved it since, and for those of you who are just listening to the whiteboard, I haven't moved it. For those of you who are watching on video, you can see back there. I don't know, maybe you guys can give me some feedback, but I don't know what I thought about it. I don't know if it really read what I was writing, maybe the whiteboard wasn't close enough.
And honestly, especially the first illustration, but even the second.
You know, it was, you know, a, it was little, a little bit, little of, a bit of a force.
You know, I know, I think that I could have made both of the points that I made using the white paper.
I think I could have made those without using it at all.
So, you know, I don't know. I kind of have mixed feelings about it.
I think I'm going to keep tinkering with it in the future.
I've seen something else that a number of preachers have done, which is
they've used a TV screen in the background behind them or next to them, standing preaching,
that kind of has the slides and whatnot. I'm not the biggest fan of the swapping back and forth
in the video feed, but I know that for some of my slides, like a picture or something like that, it definitely works better to swap back and forth.
So we're still tinkering with technology, and I feel like we're in a pretty good place.
We've learned a lot. One of our pastors has done a ton of work with technical stuff and figured out a great deal of how to make it work.
And I'm sure, kind of in the back of my head, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of other people, I'm kind of imagining that once we figure out all the details and get it all ironed out, then everything will go back to normal.
And this whole Zoom experience will be obsolete.
And some of us will say praise Jesus for that.
You know, the last thing I want to say about microphone therapist is I wasn't totally pleased with the ending.
And those of you who listen to the podcast regularly, you're probably going to laugh because I say this pretty much about every sermon, how it ended. I just feel like I may have left some stuff on the table.
I could have left something on the field.
I feel like maybe I could have left something on the field there.
I love the motif of Hinani, that word, here I am.
That's a Jewish Hebrew word for I'm here, and it's a Hebrew word that Abraham, Moses, shows up multiple times in the Old Testament in really important stories.
And it just carries with it this courageous idea that just showing up is courageous. And if you are willing to merely say hello to what God is putting in front of you, be it work that you have to do or work that he's calling you to do, that's a huge victory. And sometimes we may not feel like we have victory over or conquered somehow our loss, our pain, or suffering, but we may be able to say, Hinani, I'm here.
I'm here for it, and I guess I feel like I know just now I said it better than I said it.
In the sermon, but I wasn't super thrilled with how that one came off. So there you go. There is the microphone therapist sharing a little bit about insight into how it felt to preach this sermon in particular.
So I have a segment in the program called Killing Your Darlings.
It's typically a phrase from English literature that sort of says, if you want your story to be the best it possibly can be, you gotta kill off some stuff.
You might have to kill a character out, or remove a scene that you love, or whatever.
If you have elements in the story that are not advancing the plot, you gotta take them out.
And something similar to that is true for the sermon. almost always, if a preacher goes through the pain of cutting stuff out, the sermon ends up being a better experience, more helpful, more useful, and more resonant. It just works better if you get stuff out. So I've been trying to get this thing out, but like I said, my weeks here at the church lately have been crazy. But I've been talking about trying to encourage church members to buddy up with other families.
We're still in COVID-19. We've heard actually from other families that they have partnered up with other families that hey, we're going to consider this as a possibility, a taking part because we want to look like we're in this for the long haul, and we need support to look after one another, and so we're going to call it base camp, sort of run this small group buddy family program through the Sermons and Sermons, and we just haven't gotten it launched off the ground.
I actually have a list of resources related to this week's sermon for base camp, kind of like these things of, hey, with your family group, with your team, with the people that you are hanging out with this week, here's a couple of things that are looking at or doing.
And it's funny because I do a lot of this in the podcast already.
If you've been with us from the beginning, you know that in a lot of the show notes we have all sorts of links and articles and this and that that are related to what we talked about.
So I'm going to give those to you now because they were cut out of the sermon and they may show up here hopefully early in the week. My little video out there. But I wanted to share John Dibdahl, his book entitled Hunger. John Dibdahl was the president of my alma mater, Walla Walla University, when I was a student there. It was actually called Walla Walla College at the time. But he wrote this book about spiritual formation. And about how to be a disciple of Jesus and how to have a relationship with God, and so he talks about prayer and worship and all kind of the spiritual disciplines that we need to be people who know and walk with God well. And in the book, he has a chapter on different ways that we can conceive of God, right? And one of the ways that we can conceive of God, according to Dibdahl, is that we can kind of think of God as like a magician or a machine. Like a robot, sort of this mechanistic worldview, where if I pray this way and if I say this thing and I do it like this and I say these words, then God must follow through in X, Y, Z way. And I think that there is a way that Dibdahl sort of lays that out as a way of relating to God that isn't very helpful and certainly isn't accurate to who God is or even what he wants from us. And so I was going to talk about in the sermon, if I was going to mention it, but the way that it relates to the sermon at least is that, you know, I think one of the ways that we assume that he's mechanistic, you know, that he's like a machine, and that, you know, if I pray this way, if I say this thing, or do this thing, as I go to worship, as I go to church on the right day at the right time, or as I believe all the right stuff, then God must, XYZ. But the truth is that God is much more like a person. The Bible teaches that we are made in God's image. And so in some way, when we see people, we're seeing something like God is. And I think one of the ways that comes out is that God wants to know us and wants to walk with us. And there's that text from Micah chapter 6, where the text sort of talks about how, well, I'll read it here, I actually have it on the screen. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old, where the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and with thousands of rivers of oil? Sort of the prophet coming to God and saying, hey, I've made a mistake, I've screwed up, we've broken things with you, God. So what do we need to do to make it right? And sort of think, what coin do I need to put into the machine to smooth things over with you? And it goes on. Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression? to speak of the story of Moriah.
The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul.
And then God responds in Micah chapter 6.
God responds, I don't want your sacrifice.
I want your heart.
And it's this famous text.
He has shown you, O man, what is good.
And what does the Lord require of you?
To act justly.
To love mercy.
I think that's the most telling part.
And to walk humbly with your God.
God wants a relationship with us.
He wants to walk with us. He wants a real connection with real people.
So that was one of the resources that got left out.
And there were a whole series of other ones from the base camp that I just left out.
Let me see if I can find some more of them for you.
And then we'll move on to the next step.
But Brené Brown, she has a podcast called Anxiety and Calm Over and Over and Under Functioning.
It's very much related to loss and the fear of loss. I was going to encourage family to take a step of generosity and to give away something, I believe he may have been a pulmonologist or oncologist, and he gets sick with cancer and writes about his experience over the course of this book and eventually passes away.
And I remember one of the themes of the book is exchanging trust for control.
And of course, as we're thinking about child sacrifice, at least I made the argument that
doing these things to try to push God's hand or force God's hand is kind of a way of trying to control, and of course control is one of the things that we try to do when it comes to loss and preventing loss, and sometimes there are things we control, but sometimes we think that we can control the situation.
We can't, but then we make a mess of it, try to, and really the more helpful and the more therapeutic way of moving through with open hands and trust.
So that's some of the stuff that got left out.
The killing your darlings section of the sermon.
And let me see if there's anything else. I'm looking on my manuscript here.
There was a section in the middle that essentially completely got cut out.
And for good reason.
It was a tangent, but I was going to talk about how culture gets transmitted. So I made the argument in the middle that Abraham would have received as a kid this culture of, well, of course.
Sometimes you got to sacrifice a kid.
It's what you got to do. Nobody likes it, but it's part of life.
And sometimes you just have to do it. You have to kill a kid.
If you want your life to go well and you don't want to go through loss, sometimes you just have to do that.
And this idea that would have been inherited culturally.
And so I was thinking about telling two different stories that are both related to architecture and culture of architecture.
One of them is housing in Japan, which I've read.
Has a much shorter lifespan than housing, say, in America.
Right? So it's not uncommon at all in America for people to buy used houses.
And in most parts of America, homes are actually appreciating, meaning they increase in value, pieces of property.
But in Japan, houses are a bit more like cars. are in America, where they're depreciating pieces of property.
And so a lot of people, you know, you live in a house for 20 or 30 years or so. And when you're done living in it, you tear it down and build a new one, even if it's not totally worn out.
And there's been a lot of, like, if you read, you know, there's been a lot of, like, if you read, you know, 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 you know
Oklahoma,
despite the fact
that Oklahoma is like this major tornado
corridor,
and where basement is a super safe place to be
in a tornado. Lots of people don't have basements
because of this sort of cultural thing that's been passed down,
that the water table is too high, you just can't have a basement in
Oklahoma.
Anyway.
Culture
passes stuff
down,
and you can see why that section got left out.
The mica piece got left out. All sorts of stuff got left out in the sermon that I really liked.
But as we say, sometimes you got to kill your darlings.
Probably more darlings that made it into this thing that should have been cut in the first place.
But there you go.
There is our segment on killing your darlings.
The segment of our program that has the longest title is the one that's called Wisdom is the act of thinking something stupid and not saying it.
And this is the segment about applied wisdom.
What did I learn about craft sermon writing this week?
What are some things...
Or maybe just in general.
What have I learned about the process of putting together this thing that is the sermon?
You know, this week,
one of the things that we've been trying to do over the course of this series is incorporating testimonies, people sharing their stories.
And I think if we're able to pull it off,
I think it's a huge win for a number of reasons.
I think it's really helpful and powerful for folks to tell their stories and to share them. I think it's one of the ways that we grow, one of the ways that we see and understand, and recognize, one of the ways that we sort of integrate and process our own stories.
So I think it's important for the community to hear the stories of other people, and likewise I think it's important for community to hear the stories of other people, because I think it'll isolate and learn, and of course, you know, I try to do that and be helpful for people in the church members, whatever, but you know, if they're only hearing me, it's only from one person, and everyone knows that I screw up a lot, there's a lot to relate to if you don't feel like you're perfect, but of course I don't have the corner on the market on the story, and so I think that it's super helpful for the congregation. And Martha's testimony, which came in the form of a poem, within the sermon, almost like closing the mood of the sermon itself, and probably something that I think is interesting and cool, something that you know, over the course of the last year, as I've been able to preach at Redlands Church, I've been experimenting with this, you know, deal where I pull people into the sermon in lots of different ways. We did the calling series last summer, where we invited people to tell their stories about how they were called and so on.
on. I just think it's a powerful element, and it's something that I intend to continue and will actually continue all the way through the Mountain series, for sure. So that's something that I feel like was verified, and I got some resonance on that.
And now we're bleeding over into the next segment about impact.
But I feel like that worked really well.
I've already talked about the whiteboard, and I'm pointing over my shoulder here to those of you who are listening on the podcast.
I don't know what I think about that. I was talking to my wife, and she said, I don't think any of the visual stuff or the pictures or the PowerPoint or Prezi at times or videos or anything like that helps. I think any of that helps. I think you minimize it very, very little, and just engage with people and do a good sermon and tell good stories and be yourself and not try to have too many visuals.
And I think part of the reason she said that is because she had a hard time getting on there. My wife is not super techie, and so she was able to pick one of them. Three of them, the third one down, didn't work. But I don't think my wife is alone in that regard. There's a lot of people who struggle. Technologically, the wisdom is the act of thinking about doing something but not doing it.
And perhaps some of those sort of audiovisual media related things could be thinned out in the future.
I don't know. The part of me that really likes doing interactive polls is that I know that there's like 12 year old watching, and some, you know, maybe not so much high schoolers, but I know that there's junior high kids and some like 6th, 7th, 8th graders that are super into the polls, and I also know that a lot of people are doing it every time. I do, and they're 30 or 40 respondents on there, and so I know people are doing that, and I find it to be kind of interesting and interactive.
So I don't know if we're back, we're back in person, we'll keep doing it or not. We're talking about starting to do some worship, some church service kind of stuff outdoors.
And if we do that, we probably will not be using screens as much because screens are super hard to see. We may rely on handheld devices in one way or another.
But we'll see if we'll continue on that thing or not. There's my applied wisdom for this particular set of sermons.
As always, you hear me say this constantly, but working ahead and getting things in place ahead of time is always a welcome part of sermon writing for me.
So that's something that will continue in the coming weeks.
So we have two segments left in the program. And the next one is intent versus impact, sort of about questions I've received or suggestions or input or feedback along the way.
And I just gave some feedback that my wife shared with me.
And I have to say that I haven't gotten a ton of feedback on this sermon.
And they typically listen. So I got good feedback from them, but I think I felt their follow-up read from their dictionary, and I would get positive feedback from them. So I kind of take some of their stuff with a grain of salt. I know their love for me is greater than their ability to critique me, probably, but it's always sweet to hear their positive feedback. And I felt good about things like I mentioned. So, but if you have suggestions or questions about the program or podcast or things to do to make it better, you may say, well, put out an episode once in a while. How about that?
And it would be a good idea.
That would be a good idea.
So we're
We're trying to do that here. All right.
This is the second of this series. We'll get these episodes rolling out here.
The next one, my colleague Todd is going to be speaking with him for this next episode.
We shall see.
But there's intent versus impact. I always value your feedback.
And by the way, if you're able to leave a review,
leave a rating for the show on iTunes or on Spotify or Google Play or wherever you happen to be listening to it. In fact, you can listen to episodes right on my website,
the episodes are listed right there. You can listen to it on your computer.
And now in this episode we have a video, so it'll be on my YouTube page.
at local Instagram, but I'll put this out on YouTube and watch it on there and participate. So anyway, I would greatly value your positive reviews and ratings and comments and so on. The final segment of our program is one called Battle Preaching, and that's essentially that once you start preaching, once you kind of maybe become a preacher, you move through the world thinking about what the next sermon is going to be about. You're going to do next, you're going to talk about this, and all this sort of thing. And I found that deeply to be true. And I know that the preachers are not the only folks who have that, but I certainly do, and I always have my notebook with me, even if it's just my digital notebook. And I'm always kind of thinking about working on a Wednesday night sermon, spent some time this morning reading Barbara Taylor's Holy Envy, where she was talking about world religion teacher and the way that her own Christian faith is growing, teaching and learning about the faith tradition of other people, and got some stuff highlighted in there that will trot out. But this segment, Battle Preaching, is a time for me to share something that I picked up in the last week or two. has nothing to do with this week's sermon, but Will Trout himself out this week or two. He's actually someone I quoted in this sermon. He's an old Testament scholar. He has a podcast called The Bible Normal People, the only godly podcast on the internet. And just glorious stuff. Anyway, Peter and his fantastic podcast, he was talking about, he had a guest on, they were talking about sin. And they were talking about how sin is a metaphor and how there's actually a number of metaphors used, sort of trying to get at the idea of sin. And the most dominant metaphor, for example, on scapegoat, the Old Testament, that sort of one, and then dirty being another, probably a second most prominent metaphor, kind of gives a picture of what sin is. But then also they briefly talked about the metaphor of missing the mark, some of the ones that maybe as Christians we're the most familiar with, that's more of a Greek idea. But just really interesting, then there's the metaphor of debt, and it was just a super powerful, powerful, meaningful episode to hear them talk about how we make sense of sin. I know that's going to show up in a sermon at some point. So I listened to it, and as I was listening to it, I wrote it down because that'll preach.
So check that out.
Peter and his podcast, Bible for Normal People.
So There you go,
there
folks.
You go, folks.
We've made it,
we've made it to the end of the program.
This is Behind the Sermon, the podcast, all about the art and preaching. I am Christopher Lowen. It's been a pleasure to have you with me.
I'll see you again sometime close in the near future. We'll be diving into another sermon.
And another sermon after that.
It is a wonderful, beautiful thing that I get to
take part in
and that we get to participate in, whether we are the speaker
or the listener,
In this experience.
So thanks again for joining me.
Again, you can learn more about me and this show on my website, chrislowen.com.
That's K-R-I-S-Lowen.com
or behindthesermon.com.
Both go to the same place,
but can learn all about there.
And again, you can find this podcast on all sorts of different places, from Spotify to Apple Podcasts, anywhere good podcasts are found, you can find this show.
But thanks so much for taking the time. I would love it if when you see these episodes on social media, I would so greatly appreciate if you would share signal boost, share what you've heard, give me a little bit of a shout out, especially if you find my preaching and these comments, this kind of backstory on sermon helpful for your own life.
You know, other people might as well, and you can help them find it. So, hey, thanks so much, friends. Blessings to you.
May you know that you are enough exactly as you are loved.
And there's a place for you in this world to be, serve, and do.
Step into who God made you to be.
Blessings.